Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first e-learning of 2019. It's an e-learning of first as well, because I am being joined by Brady Farmer, our newest HR advisor. He is also doing his first presentation of all time. So our topic today, as you can see, is going to be tricky terminations. We get a lot of questions from our clients about how to handle terminations, what certain concepts mean, kind of what exposures can arise from those types of things. So we've kind of put together a unique presentation for you today that I'll explain a little bit further. But first, I need to give you a few reminders. If you have any questions at all during the presentation, there is a chat box on the bottom right-hand side of your screen. You can type those out and send them through to us. We will do our best to try to answer them during the presentation. This presentation is pretty robust. We may not get a chance to get to them during the presentation, but fear not. If we don't get to them, we will follow up with you after the presentation and we will address the question at that point. Also, in case you've missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings over at e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentation, so the written material, can be found on your member portal. This presentation is going to overlap with a bunch of concepts that we reviewed last year, so it may be handy to go back to those presentations to get more details related to certain concepts we talk about today. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind you that all of the information contained in the webinar is an overview only and is not intended to be a specific analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. As always, please contact us about any specific questions that relate to the webinar or to your workplace or any other topic for that matter, and we will answer your questions directly. Next month's e-learning is going to be February 28th, so mark your calendars accordingly. We'll be discussing all of the Employment Standards Act changes throughout the country. So without further ado, let's get started. So as you see there, we have an agenda. So what we've done today is we've set up some interesting kind of fact-based scenarios based on actual cases that have recently come before our courts and our tribunals. So we're going to outline those kind of fact patterns for you. Then we're going to go through all of the issues and kind of concepts that are arising out of that fact scenario. And then we will revisit the fact scenario and outline to you what actually happened in that particular case. And while we do this, we'll be going through those topics there. So with or without cause, the idea of a statutory notice of termination, the idea of common law reasonable notice. We're going to touch on some human rights issues that arise out of someone's termination of employment. And we're going to go through a resignation scenario. And then we're going to sum everything up at the end, give you some best practices on how to handle your termination meetings. So the first kind of area we're going to kind of delve in is with or without cause. And so the scenario is on the next slide there. And in this scenario, we have a senior employee who has 17 years of service. He has committed a serious safety violation in the course of his duties, and he's also failed to report that safety violation, even though he had an opportunity to do so. That employee, however, does have a long-standing, very clean record with us and does not have any other kind of discipline on file, and the safety violation that he did engage in did not put anyone else at risk. That said, the employer decided to terminate for cause.
So whenever you're terminated an employee, as I'm sure we've discussed with many of you, it's important to have an understanding of the basic difference between with cause and without cause. And so employers have two choices. When it comes to terminating with cause, if that's established, the employer can terminate without providing the employee with reasonable notice of termination or pay in lieu thereof, or typically any compensation at all, subject to anything that may be in an employment contract. If cause is not established, reasonable notice of termination or pay in lieu thereof, either pursuant to the common law or under the terms of the employment agreement, must be provided to the employee.
as Brady said earlier, with cause terminations, notice of termination is not required to be given from the employer to the employee. And so there are several overlapping key considerations in determining whether cause exists, and are listed there. There are three kind of primary considerations. One is how serious is the misconduct? So is the nature and extent of the misconduct major or is it minor? The second thing that might help even determine whether the conduct is major or minor are the surrounding circumstances. So, for example, are there loose application of workplace rules? So if I'm engaging in some very crude language in the back of the shop, if that's something that is kind of normal for your organization, that's a loose application of the rules, and that's going to be one factor that might not suggest my conduct is very serious. Also, maybe the employee was very poorly trained, and we know that, and they engaged in something that was unsafe. Well, that's a surrounding circumstance that might impact whether or not the conduct was very serious or not. There's a bunch of things, ultimately, that we're going to want to look at as well to the surrounding circumstances. And then the last factor is going to be, is a termination for cause the most reasonable response? So is it a proportional response to what the employee has done? And again, all these factors kind of bleed into another, because we're going to look and see, does the person have a long disciplinary record? Because if they don't, maybe it's not proportional to end the relationship for cause kind of based upon the misconduct. And one very important thing is cause is not the same as a good reason. Oftentimes, employers have great reasons to exit certain employees, whether they are for financial reasons, for performance reasons, those types of things. Just because there's a good reason to get rid of someone, that doesn't mean you have just cause or you have the ability to terminate without any notice or pay in lieu of notice. And a couple more things to consider about with cause terminations. There are a number of challenges. Now, it is a high threshold to meet when you're terminating someone for cause. And the Supreme Court of Canada has said that a termination for cause is the capital punishment of employment law. That's their actual words. And so it's a serious thing. It's not a decision that should be taken lightly. Now, what is cause and what isn't cause, that's a difficult threshold to know when it's been crossed. For example, if we're talking about employee theft, well, is kind of theft of a $5 item just cause, or does it have to be $50? Or does it have to be $100? These types of factors are also going to impact, or rather, on the factors that are surrounding the matter are going to impact that assessment. So, for example, you have someone who's in a junior role where there isn't much kind of trust required to be given to that person. Well, their misconduct might not be as serious as someone who is in a senior role where you have to trust them all the time. Now, it often takes a lot of time to build a case for cause. Now, there are obviously instances where a single element or incident will give rise to just cause, and some examples might be workplace violence, serious theft or fraud, those types of things where a one-off incident may be just cause. But oftentimes, it's a number of different things that will amount to just cause. It's kind of building up to a point where when you look at all the conduct cumulatively, that amounts to a just cause termination. So we need to build a case for cause, and we'll get to that on the next slides. And one other very important thing is that there is a procedural element associated with establishing just cause. And so what that means is that even if the employee has engaged in the behavior, you can prove that they have engaged in the behavior, and that behavior in and of itself or combined with other stuff is just cause, they have to be given a chance to address the allegations. There are a number of cases out there where the employer did not provide the employee with an opportunity to defend themselves, and the court said, yes, that conduct in and of itself would be just cause, but for you did not give that individual a chance to explain, and therefore you cannot rely upon just cause. What goes kind of hand in hand with that is if you have any evidence as it relates to the misconduct, so say you have a videotape, you need to provide the employee a chance to review what evidence you're going to be relying upon and answer to those accusations. There was a recent case where an employee kind of fell asleep at work after a number of different warnings. They had it on videotape, but they decided not to show the employee at the videotape. And the court said, because of that failure, you didn't meet the procedural element of just cause, and therefore we're not going to allow you to rely upon it. Then we've listed some things here which won't constitute cause. So oftentimes, unless there are significant performance issues in the sense of that they are doing the job bad on purpose, that's a very high threshold to get to, dissatisfaction with someone's performance is likely not going to constitute cause. Likewise, if you don't like the person's attitude, that may not constitute cause unless we're talking about ongoing insubordination type behavior. Also, unless the person's been given some significant warnings related to some of the less serious kind of misconduct that may occur in the workplace with an opportunity to improve, that also isn't going to be just cause. We need to give someone warning letters. We need to give them the support that they need to improve upon those things and reasonable time. If we discipline someone for being late, if they're just late the next day, it's likely not going to just be a kind of just cause. We need to give them some time to kind of remedy the behavior. So that's very important. And lastly, as I mentioned before, a good reason isn't necessarily just cause. And so a lack of work is not going to be just cause. That's just not what the idea is.
So as Alex was just describing, when he was discussing that, you know, we often need multiple instances of some sort of misconduct. We often refer to this as progressive discipline specifically. And so, as Alex said, in most cases, a single incident of misconduct will not justify cause for termination. You know, one lateness, even a few latenesses, may not, in and of itself, justify cause for termination. And that's where some sort of progressive discipline will be important and will come into play. And when we say progressive discipline, really what that requires is clear warnings coupled with a reasonable opportunity to correct the misconduct. So if an employee is late, you let them know that that conduct is not okay, and you provide them with time to correct that type of misconduct and start showing up on time in the future for the regularly scheduled shift. And so in this way, progressive discipline generally refers to a series of gradually sterner warnings or punishments for employee misconduct. And it usually starts with something like a verbal warning, maybe a written warning, and slowly mounts up to something more severe like a suspension or ultimately a termination for cause. And when you're doing a progressive discipline for a particular employee, detailed paperwork is absolutely key. At every stage of the process, you should have paperwork. Even if it's a verbal warning, there should be some sort of paperwork indicating that that particular employee was given a verbal warning for their misconduct. Furthermore, the warnings should include notification that similar behavior, so again, if the employee happens to be late on multiple occasions, that type of similar behavior in the future may lead to future disciplinary action up to and including termination for cause. And that way, the employee knows that if they continue acting in this particular way, that there may be severe consequences down the road. We always suggest at E2R that a company has a very clear progressive discipline policy in place. And if so, that progressive discipline policy should clearly outline the various stages or steps within the policy, and it should include steps that get progressively more severe It should explicitly allow the employer to skip and repeat steps when deemed necessary, and it should allow the employer to terminate the employee as a last resort if the misconduct is serious enough. And having this well-crafted progressive discipline policy in place at the start of any employee's employment and making sure they're made aware of that progressive discipline policy ensures that everyone is on the same page from the get-go and that nobody is taken by surprise when certain warnings are given to them and perhaps when, you know, it comes time to actually terminate them for cause.
So right before we look back on the scenario one, just to refresh your memory and then visit what the court said in that particular case, there's a couple things I want to point out, one of which is a lot of the stuff we're talking about, while the general themes do apply to unionized workplaces, so the idea of progressive discipline is definitely important in a unionized workplace, there is a lot of ideas here that are not applicable to unionized workplaces, so the idea of reasonable notice under the common law, stuff talking about employment contracts, those types of things are not going to be applicable to unionized workplaces. We're going to always want to speak to you directly about those issues because we do need to review the particulars of a collective agreement, any past practices, arbitrary law on that particular issue. So again, please note that this stuff is not universally applicable to unionized workplaces. Now, we did have a question, and the question was whether or not, I guess, in a gist, you should require an employee to sign off on a written warning or a verbal warning or that type of thing to ensure you have evidence to prove that that person got the verbal warning. Now, I'm not overly fussed about requiring an employee to sign something saying they received the actual piece of discipline for a couple reasons. One, you're going to have your oral evidence that suggests that you gave it to the employee. And two, more often than not, we all are on email systems now. And so if you email that person a copy of the written warning, that is sufficient to prove that the person actually received it. Now, if you don't have an email system, you might want to consider a sign back, but I find it in the past, asking someone to sign something can lead to more negative interactions with that individual, so it may not be worth it, but if that's the practice you want to use, I'm not overly fussed either way. So looking back at scenario one, we had a senior employee, long service, no disciplinary history. He did commit a serious safety offense, and he also did not report that offense, even though he had an opportunity to do so. The employer terminated for cause. So what did the court say? Well, the court said the termination for cause was not proportional. So we talked about that idea of proportionality. Now, the court did highlight that the employee's conduct was a serious safety violation. He had breached a rule that everyone knew about. They also pointed out that it was also serious misconduct because he failed to report the incident when he had a chance to do so. But given the employee's long tenure and the lack of disciplinary history, the court found that there wasn't just cause to terminate the employee. They would have rather you have done a lesser type of disciplinary response in the circumstances. And so what this also shows, quite frankly, is the court highlighted that there was two very serious things that happened that were bad, but even those two serious things didn't amount to just cause. So it just emphasizes that a just cause termination is a very, very high threshold. And so what the court said was, well, you don't have just cause, and therefore you owe the employee reasonable notice. And they awarded him 14 months of reasonable notice or essentially, I guess we'll outline exactly what that means because that raises some other questions as it relates to what is reasonable notice, how is it determined, what and how does it interact with the minimum employment standards and all those types of things. So Brady's going to kind of outline some of that information now as it relates to without cause terminations or when you fail to prove just cause.
So, yeah, switching over to without cause terminations. Without cause terminations are often going to be about 90%, if not more, of the terminations that we're going to help people out at E2R with. simply because of, as Alex was just describing, that very high bar and threshold to meet for terminating an employee with cause. When it comes to without cause terminations, there are two sources of liability, that under legislation and that under common law. So when it comes to the legislation, that's setting the bare minimum, the floor, and it includes statutory notice or severance pay. And severance pay specifically is often used interchangeably with termination pay or termination notice, but actually in Canada, severance pay is only applicable under Ontario and federal law. So in most cases, when we're talking about without cause termination and what's owed under the legislation, we'll stick to either statutory notice or termination pay or termination notice and not severance pay. Common law entitlements set the ceiling when it comes to without cause terminations, and that includes the entitlement to reasonable notice of termination, which Alex was just briefly describing, and we'll get into a little bit more detail soon. And just as a general note, while this seminar will not discuss employment contracts specifically, we at E2R do always stress the importance of placing your employee, both new and old, on current and valid enforceable contracts. If well drafted, such contracts can limit an employee's entitlement to notice and benefits upon termination, and can specifically reference and incorporate an employer's policies into the contract, which would include a progressive discipline policy if one existed.
Just on that note again, I just want to emphasize that we have done e-learnings in the past about the importance of employment contracts, so do not hesitate to go and revisit those materials, whether the oral presentation or even just read through like the slides. It is a great resource.
So diving a little bit more into the statutory notice periods. So each jurisdiction, both provincial and federal in Canada, has employment standards legislation in place which sets out the minimum notice requirements. So again, this is just the minimum when it comes to the legislation that's in place in each jurisdiction. And most jurisdictions provide that employees are required to have at least 3 months of employment before they are entitled to any notice of termination. And that's often referred to as the probationary period. The exceptions are in Manitoba, it's 30 days, Alberta, it's 90 days, which, yes, we're aware is basically the same as 3 months, but it is different. And then New Brunswick, PEI, and Yukon are 6 months. So a little bit more about the statutory notice. Usually requires a maximum of 8 weeks of notice after a defined period of employment, and that can range anywhere from 8 to 10 years. And again, it all depends on the specific jurisdiction in which the employee is working within. And some provinces cap out at 4 weeks, that's New Brunswick, and others at 6 weeks, that's Newfoundland. And the notice can be either working notice or pay in lieu of notice or a combination of both. Now, when we're working with a client and the object is to provide statutory notice on termination, we often advise simply doing termination pay rather than any type of working notice. And just from a practical perspective, that's often because if you're about to terminate an employee, you often don't necessarily want that employee to continue working and be in, you know, the workplace while they know that they are going to be terminated within 1 week, 2 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever it is. There's just a concern that the work product and their general attitude may decline quite substantially during that period. So when terminating and relying on statutory notice, it's also important to remember that you must keep the employee whole. And when we say that, what we're indicating is that it's not necessarily just about providing the employee with their salary for that termination notice period. Really, when it comes to that total compensation, what's important to keep in mind is not only the base salary or hourly rate, whatever it is, but what they're earning on that weekly average, but benefits as well, depending on the jurisdiction, any bonuses they might have, an RRSP, a pension plan, car allowance, any other type of benefit that they might be getting during their employment, that's likely going to have to be included during that notice period. And that's because during that notice period, the employee should be treated as if they're working in the regular course. And that's even if you're going to provide termination pay in lieu of notice. So it's always important to check the employee's employment contract to understand what it is they've been given in terms of salary and or any type of benefits.
Just on that note as well, there are going to be some circumstances when you don't have to pay a bonus if it's not payable during that statutory notice period, for example. There's a lot of moving parts, and so this is just a general overview. There will be times when those things are not owed, especially when they fall outside the statutory notice period, especially when you have a valid enforceable contract limiting you to the minimum notice period, and also what the plan documents actually say and whether they've been directed to the employee's attention at some point during their employment, et cetera. So this is just some general information. Each particular situation is going to be different. But let's talk about the idea of what common law reasonable notice is and kind of how we get to what a court might award. And so absent an enforceable employment contract, an employee is entitled to this idea of reasonable notice under the common law, meaning they have the ability to go to a court and say, court, I have been terminated. I don't have a contract. I believe I'm owed more than the floor. I'm looking for the ceiling. And so the court then will look at a number of different factors to determine what that employee's ceiling is. And there's no online calculator. There's no calculator that a judge uses to come up with this kind of amount. But essentially what they do is they look at factors such as the employee's length of service, their age, how senior is their position, what are their responsibilities, are there opportunities in that industry to find new employment. If there's not, that might increase the amount of notice that is owed, whether the employee was induced to leave a prior job to join your company, they will factor that in as well. If there isn't an employment contract and someone's assessing reasonable notice. And ultimately what they're trying to get to is how long will it take this person to find comparable employment? And they will come up with a number, generally in terms of months, and they will award that person likely total compensation as it relates to that loss between when they stopped working for you and when they should reasonably expect to find a job. Now, there is an idea that we haven't outlined here, and it's a topic unto itself on the idea of mitigation, meaning an employee has an obligation to try to minimize their losses by looking for a new job. There's a bunch of kind of ideas that go along with that that can reduce that reasonable notice number. But ultimately, when we're talking to you on the phone about what your exposure is, we're giving you a sense of what your ceiling might be if the employee goes to a judge and asks for reasonable notice. So there's a couple more points to keep in mind. Now, oftentimes people use this rough rule of thumb, which is 1 month per year of service, a give or take, as it relates to what someone's reasonable notice period is. So if we have a manager, for example, who's been with us for 5 years, the rule of thumb, which has been rejected by our courts, would say they're entitled to roughly about 5 months' notice. Now, I can tell you anecdotally, that most awards generally shake out around 1 month per year of service, kind of give or take some factors. Now, there's an upper limit generally of 24 months. Now, that upper limit in recent years has been exceeded, but only in exceptional cases. And by exceptional, I mean very, very long service employees who are of an advanced age. So someone, for example, has been with you for 35 years and is 65 years of age, setting aside some of the human rights concerns that might be associated with that kind of termination. Those types of people have been awarded a notice in excess of 24 months. And so when you're speaking with us and we give you an idea of what the exposure might be, you are able to give working notice, kind of subject to the things that Brady highlighted earlier about the risks about working notice, but you are able to give working notice of this reasonable notice. You can offset a large, significant kind of financial liability if you're able to give someone working notice. And so if someone were entitled to 12 months of notice or reasonable notice, you could give them 6 months of working notice to offset some of that, and you're getting some kind of something for your buck. Now, you can't make that choice after you've terminated them. That choice has to be made in advance of you terminating them. So we got to keep that in mind. And so, as Brady mentioned, we need to keep the person whole throughout the notice period. So all of their RSP contributions, potentially bonus depending upon certain factors, the kind of personal aspect of a car allowance, so all factors of someone's remuneration. Now, that's what a court would award when we're kind of developing a termination offer. We might stay silent on some of those things to try to get you a more advantageous offer, but this is what we mean when we're talking about exposure. And so one last point I want to point out about notice: short service employees tend to get a disproportionate amount of notice. So there's a bunch of cases out there where there's some like high-level executives who have only been employed for 6-8 months maybe, and their notice period almost equals the amount of time that they were actually working for you, so 6 to 8 months of reasonable notice. And the idea being it might take that person in that senior role that long to find a new job and replace their income. And just one final point that's there, it's the second last point, though, under the common law, there is no probationary period. So if you don't have an employment contract with a clear probationary period, if you terminate someone within their first 3 months or 90 days in Alberta or the various probationary periods that were outlined earlier in the presentation, while there is no floor, because there's no minimum notice owed, there still could be a common law exposure when you're terminating someone during the statutory probationary period where you don't have an enforceable contract.
So now we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to start discussing how certain human rights obligations in the employment context can connect to terminations of an employee, whether that be without cause or with cause, and how those interlink with one another. So for our second scenario, we're going to imagine an employee employed for 13 years. In the year before the employee was terminated, the employee missed 10 work days due to a slip and fall, 2 days of work after a miscarriage, 9 days of work after her mother-in-law died, and a number of full and partial days for a total of 46 hours for health-related reasons. Due to the absences, the employee failed to meet minimum billing targets for the year and exceeded her annual allotment of sick time. At the end of the year, before termination, the employer met with the employee to discuss concerns with her absences from work. These concerns were also reflected in her annual performance review. The employer decided to terminate the employee 2 months after the annual performance review, and the employee alleged she asked for but was not provided a reason for her termination. The employer alleged she was told it was due to a lack of work with no opportunity to move to a different group. On this basis, the employee brought a human rights complaint alleging her termination was discrimination on the basis of her disability.
So when we're terminating someone, we need to be mindful of what is a protected ground of discrimination, and we'll explain as relates to why that's important. But we've outlined here very briefly some of the overlapping protected grounds that are the same in all provinces. Now, each province lists their own protected grounds, and so some are longer, some are shorter, some have been interpreted differently. But in general, the major ones are age, disability, which includes a dependency on alcohol or drugs, marital or family status. Again, we have a number of e-learnings on human rights in general, the duty to accommodate, which we'll get to in a second, on the issue of family status. All these have been explored in depth and just are kind of beyond the breadth of this presentation. Race or color, religion, sex, which includes pregnancy and childbirth and sexual orientation. So in effect, employers are prohibited from taking negative action against an employee, whether that's a disciplinary action or a termination, kind of based in whole or in part on one of those protected grounds. And so when we're looking at someone's performance, we need to determine, quite frankly, if there's an impact on that performance that might relate to a prohibited ground of discrimination. Because if there is, we have an obligation to accommodate up to undue hardship. And these are very unique terms that need to be explored in depth, but we just need to be mindful that if we're terminating someone, essentially, we need to determine if there is an impact or if there's a protected ground that's impacting the reason why we're terminating them. And if it's based upon their performance or their absences or those types of things, we need to explore whether or not we have an accommodation obligation first before we terminate them. And so when we talk about accommodation, we just want to highlight that an employee is not entitled to perfect accommodation, meaning they aren't necessarily entitled to what they're asking for. They're entitled to reasonable accommodation, and they must work with the employer to determine what is reasonable and what is meeting their needs or their protected ground, but still also meets your operational needs. So it is a balance. We can terminate someone, however, without additional human rights exposure if an employee is unable to perform the essential duties of their job, even with accommodation. So, for example, if we have an employee who suddenly needs to drop down to one day per week for a family status reason, but if their job is a full-time job and we've explored reasonable accommodation, well, they can't meet their obligations anymore because they can only work one day a week, and so that wouldn't be necessarily a violation of their human rights. Likewise, if there is a disability and we have medical documentation that says they are unlikely to return to their job for the foreseeable future, well, then we might be in a position to say that the contract just cannot continue as it was intended through no fault of either the employer or the employee, and thus doesn't give rise to any human rights issues there. Now, an employer will be found to have violated an employee's human rights in the employment context if the employer does terminate the employee in whole or even in part. We're talking 1% of the reason for someone's termination if it relates to someone's protected ground. And it's like the major one is someone's disability, whether that's an actual disability or a perceived disability. And we also will be found to have violated their human rights if we cannot prove that we attempted to accommodate them before we decided to proceed with their termination. And one only needs to prove a connection between the adverse treatment, in this case, the termination, and the grounds of discrimination. And so Bray's going to look back at scenario two and kind of let you know where we are there.
So just a quick, refresher. The employed for 13 years, missed a number of days due to a slip and fall, a miscarriage, and some, health-related reasons. The employer decided to terminate, and the employer said the termination was due to a lack of work with no opportunity to move the employee to a different group. And on this basis, the employee decided to bring a human rights complaint alleging that the termination was based on her particular disability, and that would be related to the sickness, the miscarriage, the slip and fall, or any of the above. In this particular situation, the tribunal said that in order for the employee to establish discrimination, the employee had to prove her disability-related absences were one factor, possibly among many, in the employer's decision to terminate her employment. So that's what Alex is just getting at. And to reiterate the very important point here, it does not have to constitute the majority reason for discrimination to be made out. If just one small, tiny part of the reason to terminate the employee was based on that particular protected ground, the case for discrimination could be made out and would be made out. So in this case, the employer led evidence that the employee was terminated due to a lack of work, including a stakeholder's decision to eliminate certain positions, one that the employee occupied, and a slowdown in the real estate market, which negatively affected the employer's business. The employer even indicated on the record of employment that the termination was due to a shortage of work. The tribunal held that the temporal connection between the employer expressing concerns about the employee's absences, because if you recall, there was a discussion about this on the annual review for the employee, and the termination of the employment, that it was sufficient to require the employer to provide reasons for the employee's termination. So here we have that the employee was able, in this case, to at least make the case that discrimination may have been made out, that the decision to terminate may have been based on her particular disability in these circumstances. And because of that, the onus then switched to the employer to prove that this particular termination was in no way related to that particular disability. And on that basis, the employer was able to use the evidence that essentially the termination was in no way based on that particular disability, and that the bad timing itself was not sufficient to make out the case for termination.
So I guess what the court's saying there is, quite frankly, yes, if there is an optic there where there is some bad timing as it relates to someone's termination, for example, I come forward with a disability on Wednesday and I'm terminated the following Wednesday, bad timing in and of itself is going to give rise to the obligation for the employer to then prove that it has nothing to do with my recent disclosure and everything to do with some other reason. And that's why it's very important, if there are performance issues or if there are these types of things, that they are documented. So then if we are kind of called upon to answer the question, why is this person being terminated if it's not for their recent medical disclosure, we have a good answer for that. And so we want to consider one counterpoint, and there's some facts here that kind of go the other way against the employer because they didn't do exactly what I said. So in this case, there was a VP of Western Canada. She was terminated within her probationary period one day after informing her employer that she was pregnant. And the company claimed that the termination was for financial reasons only, and that it was closing one of its operations, I guess its operation in BC, where she was kind of hired to work. And the company took the position that it had nothing to do with her recent disclosure of her pregnancy. In that case, the tribunal held that the employer did discriminate against the employee on the basis of sex, which includes pregnancy. Now, they noted that the timing alone it just raises a red flag. There's no two ways about it. Like kind of based upon the timing alone, red flags are raised. And then the tribunal then looks to and says, okay, well, if it's not that employer, what is it? And in this case, they had no evidence, no written evidence or no corroborating evidence to support their story that it was unrelated. And so because they were unable to answer the reason or the question why, the only logical conclusion for the tribunal was because of her recent disclosure. So that highlights the importance of making sure we have documented reasons as to why, so we can rebut that presumption. One important thing to also note too, the employer wasn't protected simply because the person was in their probationary period. Oftentimes there's a misunderstanding amongst our clients that because someone's in their probationary period, we can terminate them and there's no obligation. Well, that's not true. Like the rights under the protections under human rights start even before the person becomes your employee. It goes all throughout the interview process. All of that, those protections are there right from the first time that you're introduced to that individual, and they continue once they're hired and then through the probationary period. So if they're terminated during their probationary period, they still have those protections. And it's also important to note that even if you have a really good contract and you're saying, oh, we're terminating them without cause, that also doesn't matter either, because if there's a breach of their human rights, with or without cause really doesn't matter, because they are now have been terminated in part at least because of a protected ground, and that gives rise to extra liability, and you can't stand behind your actual written contract, that's not going to insulate you from those large damage awards that are awarded by our human rights tribunal.
So we're going to move forward to resignations now. We get a lot of calls about potential resignations, actual resignations, and there's a lot of confusion surrounding exactly what does constitute a valid resignation. So for an additional scenario to consider, we're going to work with an employee who worked as a law clerk for a particular lawyer for 7 years. The employee was informed another law clerk would handle some of the lawyer's work. The employer knew that the two law clerks did not get along. The employee was upset and gathered her personal belongings and returned to her security pass and went home. The employer did not attempt to contact the employee, and the employee did not contact anyone for 5 days. The employer did not allow the employee to return to work after the 5 days, taking the position that the employee resigned. So what we want to know in this particular circumstance is whether or not that really would be a valid resignation, and if on this basis there would be any liability on the employer's part. So when it comes to a resignation, there's three very important elements to consider any time that you think an employee may have resigned. One, the resignation always has to be voluntary. And so sometimes we get into situations where an employer or a company may want to nudge or ask a particular employee to resign from a particular position, and that's always a risky scenario to get into. Because if it's truly voluntary, the employee should be coming to you on their own seeking to resign from their position. Secondly, there's a subjective element to any resignation, and that's whether the words and conduct clearly demonstrate a subjective intention to quit. And same with the objective, what I'll get to in a second here is that really this is all around, does, you know, one particular outburst where an employee gets particularly angry in the heat of the moment count as a resignation, or is it something more level-headed and cool where the employee likely had some time to think about and consider their circumstances and consequences of their actions? And so that's where the objective element comes into play, and that's where we would ask if the conduct of the employee resigning, if a reasonable person would understand that as carrying out the subjective intention to quit. So again, is it one particular outburst? Do they just happen to leave to go catch some air after a particularly heated argument with another employee or someone in management? Or did perhaps they come to you with a written resignation letter? Or did they provide you an email that clearly took at least a little bit of time to draft and that you knew they'd be considering the circumstances? Also important to consider with any resignation is whether or not they are revocable. And the short answer is yes, they are. And so this is why paperwork is always important in this regard for any company or employer dealing with a potential resignation as well. The resignation is possibly going to be revocable unless the employer has accepted it. And the easiest way to accept any resignation is to provide a letter to the employee stating that you have accepted their resignation, letting them know that they'll get their pay up to the end of the resignation notice period, and that on that particular day that they outlined as their last day, their employment will be essentially at an end with the company. Alternatively, if the company has acted to its detriment on the employee's intention to resign, it may not be revocable either. And that may be a circumstance where the company has already hired a new employee to fill that role, or perhaps made some sort of business decision based on that intention to resign. And in this way, a court or whoever will really treat the resignation as an offer. And so in that way, that's where the acceptance of the resignation becomes vitally important. Because when an employee resigns, they're simply offering that resignation on the table. And if it's not accepted at any point, they can simply retract that offer to resign. Specifically in terms of working out the resignation notice period, and that would be the period in which the employee asks to continue working, often 2 weeks, maybe a little bit more or a little bit shorter depending on the circumstances, it's important that an employee should, in most circumstances, be permitted to work out that notice period. And similar to the statutory notice period, they should be made whole during that period. They should get all their regular salaries and benefits, bonuses depending on the circumstances, obviously of any contract and any terms for that bonus, but certainly their regular rate of pay, vacation pay, and everything else during that resignation notice period. And if not, the employer should be willing to provide the employee with pay in lieu of that resignation notice period and any benefit continuation that may be required. And just as a special note, when it comes to Quebec specifically, refusing to allow an employee to work out their notice period is deemed to be termination and can give rise to additional liability.
We have that scenario there again. Just a refresher, we had a law clerk, worked for one lawyer for a while, didn't like some of the changes that were happening. She kind of left in a bit of a huff. She grabbed her belongings. She gave a security pass. No one contacted each other for a number of days. The employee wanted to return after that, and the employer said, no, you've resigned. Now, what did the court say? Well, the court found that in this case, the employee's actions did not constitute a proper resignation. They found that she was wrongfully terminated, therefore, when she wasn't allowed to return to work. Now, as Brady said, for a valid resignation, it must be clear and unequivocal. So in order to be clear and unequivocal, there must be an objective intention to resign. So the courts looked at all the surrounding circumstances and looking at all those, whether an objective person would have understood that the employee resigned. In this case, they decided that that wasn't the case, and they found that it was a spontaneous kind of action on the part of the employee, and it was a highly charged situation, and therefore it undermined the voluntariness of what she did. Now, had the employer confirmed her resignation in writing, perhaps after she left, saying you took your stuff, you gave back like your security pass, we're taking that as your resignation, things may have been different, but because there was nothing that was said kind of on both sides of the table, the court found differently. And so they also looked at a bunch of factors that we outlined here very quickly. She was a long service person. She was called into a meeting without any notice, and that was kind of giving rise to this whole adversarial nature of things. They made her work with someone they knew that she didn't get along with. There was no attempts when she gave back the security pass to say, well, kind of, what does this mean? Those types of things. So all those factors are going to be looked at to determine whether or not someone has a true intention to resign. And so we're going to go through one final thing here with you, and then we're going to wrap up. So please stay with us. We have a couple minutes left. So Bray's going to go through some of the key things to keep in mind when you are conducting the termination meeting.
We often get asked exactly how this particular meeting should be handled. And just as some general points, the meeting should clearly be held in private. You don't want to be holding it in front of any of the other employees. The meeting should be conducted ideally with the employee's direct manager, and likely best practice would be to have a second representative present. The employer should hand the employee the termination package and provide the employee with some sort of brief explanation for the termination. We often get asked about this specifically as well, and we always advise never to lie in this particular circumstance. Be honest, but be brief as well. You don't need to get into a protracted conversation about the specifics of any performance issues or anything they're having. It's best just to keep it brief and short and sweet in that regard. And if appropriate in the circumstances, you can review the letter and highlight the terms and conditions of the severance package or any release with the employee at that time. It's very important that you do not accept the employee's agreement to the severance package or the executed release during that time. You always want to give the employee time to go home and actually consider the particular terms of any release or severance package, just so they have the time to fully consider the consequences of it. You should instruct the employee to return all company property. You should offer the employee options regarding the collection of personal belongings, whether you know that them getting them now or perhaps you mailing them at a later date to the employee. You should confirm that the record of employment will be sent to the employee after payroll has been processed, and ideally confirm that the employee has a safe way home. And an easy way to do this is to offer to pay for a taxi, perhaps with a prepaid taxi chit, because people in these circumstances may not really be the best selves, and it's always helpful and ideal to make sure that after this particular ordeal and circumstance, they're going to be getting home safely.
And just to follow up on that, on the reasons piece about giving the individual reasons, now some people kind of find that to be a constructive exercise, and some individuals who are being let go kind of want to know kind of really for personal development reasons kind of why they're being let go so they can kind of not make the same mistakes on a go-forward basis. And that's fine if you are kind of comfortable doing that, but it really shouldn't become a negotiation. Like, your decision has become final, and it's not there for the individual to argue against why they shouldn't be let go. Also, keep in mind, too, that if there are some kind of background issues, maybe there was a recent medical leave, those types of things, if you have a real good reason, for example, their whole department is being let go for business reasons, we want that to be kind of very clearly clearly communicated to that person, so they aren't left leaving the meeting kind of thinking, well, the only thing I can think of, because they're not giving me any reasons, is because of my recent medical leave. So you want to kind of, I'm like, kind of really nip that in the bud early on, so you can get past that potential optic issue. Now, when Brady says you need to be honest, that's important up to a point, right? So if we don't want to mislead someone as to why they're being terminated, because then if we do that and they do sign a release after reviewing the termination package at home, they could argue that the release should be set aside if they do in fact kind of find out the reason why they were terminated after the fact. So if they were terminated for a breach of their the human rights, for example, and they can prove that after the fact, if you kind of misled them, and I'm not telling you to say that during the meeting, I'd be very vague in that circumstance, but if you gave them a completely different reason that wasn't true, then they could argue that the release isn't enforceable and you're not protected because you misled them to get that release signed. Now, right before we conclude, we did have a question, and it was a process question as it relates to what do we do when the individual we are terminating doesn't work in the office or isn't close to the office? And I'm not overly fussed if you're terminating a remote employee over the phone. I don't expect you to jump on a plane to travel across the country for some lower level individual who is working from home. If it's a senior person, I would probably suggest that an in-person meeting might be appropriate, but you can conduct a termination over the phone. But if you're going to do that, be very clear that there is someone else on the phone with you as a witness, and then make sure that you are getting them the kind of all the paperwork one way or another, and then also have a means to collect any of the company property as well. So in conclusion, we went through with or without cause termination. So we're always going to want to see whether or not the contract has an existing valid termination provision. That's going to kind of speak to what your obligation is going to be as it relates to without cause of termination. And we're also then, if there isn't a valid employment contract with a valid termination provision, we're going to want to consider what that reasonable notice exposure is when we're putting together what offer we are going to be making to the individual. And if we're going to be alleging cause, keep in mind that is a very high bar to meet, and we need to look at all the surrounding circumstances and explore whether corrective discipline has been followed or if that is a more appropriate means to deal with things. Now, quite frankly, even if we don't have just cause, sometimes we may decide just to not go down the progressive disciplinary road and just exit the individual without cause, because if we keep them around, they may be costing us more money in the long term. We also talked about some of the impact someone's protected grounds may have on a termination. So we always need to be mindful of any skeletons in the closet, as I call them, as it relates to, are there any recent issues that might be pointed to as the reason why someone is being terminated and what that might mean in the context of exposure. Obviously, resignations are very unique, and there are a lot of moving parts, and so we need to make sure that we are accepting resignations properly. We need to address whether someone is revoking the resignation like within the allowable time periods set forth by the law and those types of things. But each situation is going to be unique, that's for sure. And so if you have any particular questions as it relates to someone's entitlements, what the exposure might be, those types of things, we are always here to walk you through that process and to help you paper it if necessary. If you have any questions about the presentation or anything else, we are always here. I want to thank you for joining us on the first e-learning of the year, and we will be back at the end of February, again, February 28th, I believe, to talk about all of the lovely lovely changes to our employment standards legislation across the country. So on behalf of Brady and myself, we'd like to thank you and enjoy the rest of your day.